This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 5th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 416. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, in time for Taiwan's 114th National Day on October 10th, highlights of a panel discussion featuring Invisible Nation filmmaker Vanessa Hope, Taipei Economic and Cultural Office Director Angel Liu, University of BC Professor Yves Tibergen, and Asia Pacific Foundation's Vina Najibullah. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. October 10th is Taiwan's 114th National Day. The Democratic Island Nation is roughly the size of Vancouver Island and boasts more than 23 million people. Taiwan is under threat from Xi Jinping, who vows to annex Taiwan, even by force. From 2016 to 2024, its president was law professor Tsai Ing-wen, the first woman to hold the top job in Taiwan. Tsai Ing-wen was the subject of the 2023 documentary by Vanessa Hope called Invisible Nation. After the Vancouver screening of Invisible Nation on August 27th, Vanessa Hope joined remotely in a panel discussion with moderator Vina Najibullah, Vice President of the Asia Pacific Foundation of Canada, Angel Liu, the Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office, and University of BC Political Science Professor Yves Tibergen. Here is Invisible Nation Director Vanessa Hope.
I first went to Taiwan in 1995-96, which was the year they became a democracy. I was only a student. I borrowed my Mandarin language teacher's camera for the first time ever and went filming. And that footage is in this film. So that question, having lived and studied in Beijing first in the 1990s, early 1990s, and then to be in Taiwan and be present when they became a democracy, stuck with me when I went to work in foreign policy at a think tank and became fascinated with questions of diplomacy and international relations and how the United States handled the situation in normalizing diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China while cutting off relations with Taiwan, what happened, how Taiwan became a democracy. All of these questions stuck with me throughout my adulthood, really. And I made a first documentary looking at the US-China diplomatic relationship following former President Obama's US ambassador to China, John Huntsman. And that was one way into the story that Taiwan was a part of, but I knew that Taiwan deserved their own movie and story. And I felt I was not taught it in school properly. It wasn't discussed fully at the think tank where I worked. And it was something I could only learn if I went to Taiwan and I listened to people on the ground there and did interviews in Taiwan. So it happened that the first film came out in 2015. So in January 2016, I joined this international delegation to monitor that the elections in Taiwan were free and fair. And we had no idea whether President Tsai Ing-wen would win or not. And I met everyone from every different party. And then we happened to be in the crowd with the DPP supporters when President Tsai won. And it was incredibly exciting and electric and historic. And I felt like if there was any way to gain access to Taiwan's first female president, in a year, if you remember, in 2016, when the US had an opportunity to potentially elect a woman president, and this was on everyone's minds, it would make an incredible story, a film, a way into understanding Taiwan and sharing their story with the world. So that's where this came from.
This is the voice of moderator Vina Najibullah of the Asia Pacific Foundation.
Fantastic. And in the last 2 years since the film has been released, What has been the impact, or what was the impact that you were seeking, and have you been?
Really phenomenal. I have been so moved by the audiences all over the world. We've played in 40 festivals all over the world. Everyone feels connected to Taiwan and its story, or they feel shocked and dismayed that they did not know Taiwan's story sooner, and why was that story being repressed, and how could they help, and what did Taiwan need, and just the injustice of it. I think it's very moving to people outside Taiwan who still confuse Taiwan with Thailand, or once upon a time did. I mean, that unfortunately sticks. And for people who are of Taiwanese or Chinese descent, it's just really moving. It's been very meaningful to be able to share it and discuss it.
But I wanted to invite Angel to maybe share a few thoughts from a perspective of obviously a Taiwanese official here in Canada, in terms of what has been the reaction that you've seen in Canada and the showings in Montreal and in Ottawa, and also from your perspective, sort of any, what does this mean as you're seeing deepening of cultural and economic ties with Canada?
This is Angel Liu, the Director General at the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office.
I think it has been selling very good in Taiwan, and it's a welcoming movie here in Canada, not only in Vancouver, but in Montreal, in the East Coast. And thanks to our partner, Asia Pacific Foundation, for sponsoring the filming and screening. And I would say that the Taiwanese audience has been resonated with the message the film has been sending, that Taiwan is a sovereign country. It is a country with multicultural people that include Holocaust, indigenous, and other groups of people that may be migrating to Taiwan over the centuries. So we don't want to be called Chinese Taipei. We want to be acknowledged in international society as Taiwan. And also there is a message in the film that the people in Taiwan want to develop a strong national identity that trigger the results of the past few presidential election in Taiwan. And according to the film, we learned from the experience of Hong Kong Yellow Umbrella Movement and their Sunflower Movement. And the film also shows the Taiwan Pride Parade, and signifying that Taiwan, telling people the message that Taiwan is the first country in Asia that legalized the same-sex marriage. So the film wants to show people that Taiwan is a society, is a country with inclusive values and democracy values. And they also interviews a lot of foreign correspondents, scholars from across all borders, from United States, from Taiwan, and they who watch the Taiwan Strait crisis or Taiwan Strait situation on a frequent basis. So basically it's a very interesting and touching story for all the Taiwanese audience, and also a very good film for foreign policy watchers in Canada to learn more about the country of Taiwan and how Taiwanese people see our country, and how do you develop a future relationship with Taiwan based in the perspective that we are all from a democratic country.
Thank you so much, Angel. Eve, when I first saw the documentary almost a year and a half ago, we were in a very different moment where sort of the ideas of democratic solidarity, especially because of Ukraine, were very, very high. And of course, U.S. Had the Biden administration still. I think we're in a very different world since the documentary first came out. And certainly ideas of democratic solidarity maybe, or sort of, but there's, I think, a lot more doubt about that. So I wanted maybe to turn to you to bring us more to the present, because obviously the film ends at a certain point in time, and the last year, the last 6 months have been quite eventful. So maybe if you could unpack the current geopolitical situation and what's happening between U.S. and China, and how that's impacting that peace and stability in Taiwan that everybody wants. I think that the documentary ends with a hopeful note of maintaining peace and stability and freedom and openness of Taiwan. How is that looking right now?
UBC Professor Eve Tibergen.
Well, I wanted to start by congratulating Vanessa for a fascinating, really moving documentary, because that's, you know, I teach international relations. International relations can be cold or tragic. You know, this famous book, The Tragedy of Great Politics. Mm-hmm. But this brings the human side of Taiwan, and it brings the voice of Taiwanese and a lot of different voices, and many are represented in the documentary, which is great, including the dialogue between the two presidents, which is really hard to do. So congratulations for bringing this humanity to this whole situation, and getting, in this case, Canadians to feel closer to what Taiwanese feel and have experienced. I will also say I was involved doing a documentary in the past in Taiwan, 2013. I was leading a French crew that did the whole documentary at the time. It was on US-China relation, and I advised them to go do this in Taiwan rather than try to do it in China at the time. And we got to interview Joseph Wu for a couple hours. It was fascinating, as he always is, and many, many other people. I will also say I was here during the last election, 2024, and I experienced this kind of same electric atmosphere, you know, in all the rallies, and tried to attend all three parties. I visited leadership of all three parties, and I was talking to citizens the night of the election, and I heard from so many, you know, we fought for this election, we were there in the early 90s fighting, and now we experience democracy, and we're so happy about it. So that joy on election nights is something extraordinary that we feel in Taiwan. I also visited the electoral booth and how they were opening the ballots, and it was really very well done. You know, not many countries know how to do this right, but you know, Canadians are good at this too. But Taiwanese, it was, you know, very clean, public. You could go and watch any voting centers, and everything was done in a couple hours, and everybody accepted the results, and you know, that was quite a demonstration. So that was the 2024 January. But yes, we are in a different world. I think I would lie if I was saying that Taiwanese have not been shocked this year. There is the reality has been harsh, as it is in India, as it is in Vietnam, as it is in Indonesia, as it is in Japan, right? It's been harsh around Asia, it's harsh around the world. And so far, it may not be for long, but so far, the U.S. has been pretty harsh at Taiwan. The trade negotiations have been painful, and Taiwan has ended up having a worse deal than Japan and Korea, the two closest, you know, with 20% current tariff as opposed to 50%. On top of it, it's deductible, so it's additional, it's not an exclusive one. You know, that's where I guess some people miss the sharpness of Tsai Ing-wen as a trade rep, as a trade minister, right? And she was so good at trade. But it's a tough reality out there. And there were remarks from the U.S. president that were shocking for Taiwanese. Now, this is part of a big game. This is a big transition in geopolitics. Everything is moving. There's a lot of volatility and uncertainty. It's not the end of it. And I think many Taiwanese know that they matter in terms of their democratic reality and the geopolitical situation. So there is also still a lot of support. But there is a lot of concern currently about the so-called silicon shield, because in harsh, cold IR reality, right, it's important to acknowledge, yeah, that what's hard to explain, but there's also a lot of pain or a lot of emotions on the Chinese side. And the best way to maintain peace and to protect that beautiful society that Taiwan has built is to manage that, right? And one way Taiwan has been managing this is through the silicon shield, which has become indispensable in semiconductors. And so that's part of the, you know, what makes Taiwan immune to war potentially. And that's all under negotiation right now, and this is difficult. So yeah, there's a lot of debates within Taiwan about this current reality. And I think Taiwanese appreciate the fact that in Canada, there's no such big change, that all Canadians who is in Taiwan appreciate the beauty of the society, how generous, hospitable people are, what they have built over all these years. And even I wrote a book on the pandemic in East Asia, and it was fabulous what Taiwan has done, probably the number one in terms of success. And so, yeah, I think this documentary allows us to enter into that window to feel what Taiwan is feeling.
Vanessa, maybe if I could turn to you first to kind of speak from your experience of making the documentary all the time that you spent in Taiwan on the kind of the psychological effects of living with the pressure and the kind of growing escalation of aggression from the PRC, sort of what was that like, especially with different people that you interacted with, and any other impressions from the question that Ravana asked, the first question?
Thank you. I think for hearing, I couldn't quite hear everyone clearly, so it was very helpful when you repeat the question. So yes, I can answer the one you just posed about psychologically how people living in Taiwan are managing the threat and living with it. There, unfortunately, for a long time, there have been air raid drills. I mean, that's not unfortunate, that's smart preparation, but it's just upsetting being there, realizing that people have lived for a very long time with this danger and an awareness of it. But over the course of the time I was filming, these new organizations started to pop up, especially in the last couple of years, to help people with civil defense, to help people who are citizens learn how to help each other should they be wounded or injured, what to do in an emergency situation, almost like a medic or a nurse. And I think a lot of people in Taiwan are training. I think one of the, I loved everything Eve said. I've loved everything everyone has said on this panel that's so sensitive to what's really going on in Taiwan. And I feel like people there have a good sense of trust that the society is welcoming to foreigners, but it's also very trusting and warm and cohesive in a way that, say, a place like the United States is not right now. So I hope that that works to Taiwan's advantage, because I think there's a strong sense of community and identity and helping each other and protecting each other.
Great. Thanks so much, Vanessa. On the point in terms of societal preparedness, it was interesting on my last trip to Taipei to hear from officials there about working with other countries like Finland, which have been on the kind of living next door, in this case, to Russia, and how every citizen is much more prepared, and even sort of the kind of all the material that they have and the ways in which average people in Finland are ready to that threat and kind of how they've been dealing with it has been really interesting. So I really appreciated that kind of exchanges that are now happening between particularly the Baltic states, Finland, Eastern Europeans, and Taiwan as well. And of course, I mean, there's a lot that can be shared. Even in the case of Canada, we have a lot of disaster readiness response, which I think would be really interesting areas for us also to collaborate, which kind of goes to the point of what is happening in Canada. Eve, maybe if I could come to you on the question around sort of the silence, particularly from the federal government, maybe on the issues. I think the gentleman who asked the question rightly pointed out that Ottawa is quite busy at the moment, like everybody else with Washington, so that's understandable. But I don't know if you want to say something, especially as part of our Indo-Pacific strategy and what has been happening, both sort of that you feel are hopeful, but also the challenges.
Yeah, all kind of great questions. So thank you. I'll say quickly something on Ramana's question. So the legal structure, the constitution, is under this ROC construction. That's how it was established, as the Kuomintang came back to when they moved to Taiwan post 49. Initially, it was a dictatorship and then it was democratized, but it's under that name and that constitution as it was finally revised in the 90s. So to change that would require, first of all, a change of constitution, and it's a high level of regime change, right? And there is no consensus for that within Taiwan, first of all among the parties. So currently the Kuomintang and the TPP, not DPP, would not support that, and they have majority in parliament, and in general you would need anyway a very super majority to change that level. So the DPP has adjusted to that reality and lives with it, interprets it. And the other aspect of it is that it would probably trigger a crisis in IR. So there's an IR dimension as well as the domestic reality. So the risks are high, the costs are high, the benefits not immense relative to the risk, right? And the consensus issue, but
international relations, IR, just in case we're in the room, we don't have all students of international relations, not just the
room. Well, clearly China would escalate a lot in reaction to this. And a lot of countries would actually feel it's unnecessary to do that crisis. So it's not only China in that sense. Then for the question of what Canada is doing, I'll first give the background. So Canada was before many countries, just after France in the 60s in trying to open relationships. Well, at the time, we're still recognizing RSC, therefore Taiwan as China, but wanted to also open relation with China because they had 20% of the world population. And international relation, again, you can't do anything in global politics without the big countries. You know, you can't solve an economic crisis. You can't, many, many things. You require big countries to work together at some point. And so it was like, oh, well, we really need to involve them. So Canada was trying, like France before, to do a two-China policy. And say, we'll still be close to Taiwan, but we will open diplomatic relation with China. And China blocked that, right? As now with France, China did not block in 64. It was Chiang Kai-shek who blocked that. And he said, if you start talking to PRC, it's done with you guys. I don't want to talk to you anymore. But by 70, it was 1970, then China had changed its approach, was getting organized and decided that this is the price you have to pay. And eventually, unlike the US, unlike what we heard, Canada has a policy to take note. So first, Canada recognized China as the legitimate government of China, the PRC, right? But the PRC did this. But second, takes notes only of China's position on Taiwan and neither challenges it nor supports it. So that's where Canada officially has a little more flexibility than many, including the US. Canada's never said we support, as we heard President Carter.
Acknowledge versus take note, right?
Right.
For those who study diplomacy, these are differences.
Right. Yeah. Canada's very proud of that innovation. So there's that wiggle room. But still, in order to function, to still be able to sit at G20 or sit at the UN with China, Canada, like all major countries, are falling under a kind of one China policy. Not principle, that's a Chinese view. You call it one China policy. And so it's under that parameters that Ottawa and then all the provinces are operating. Now, that still leaves a lot of room, especially when the feelings are so close. And so recently, since the IPS, the Indo-Pacific Strategy of 2022, which mentioned Taiwan explicitly 8 times, which was new. So it's not a given. There is room to do more on trade, on science, on health, on education, on indigenous technology, right? And there is a science and tech agreement in 2024. There's a investment agreement in 2023, and so on and so on. And there is, of course, for young people, work holiday visa and all this. So there is a desire to do as much as possible under this larger parameters.
Thank you.
Eve and Angela, if I can turn to you, Eve, I know you're coming to Taiwan, you're leaving, you're going on a sabbatical. Maybe just a word of sort of what are your hopes for Canada-Taiwan moving forward? And then the same question for you, Angel, before we wrap up.
My biggest hope is, you know, so I've been a bit saddened to see the polarization in Taiwan this year. And Taiwan really needs to come together. So my number one hope is to be back in the spirit of 2024 January, what I saw in the election, which was amazing. And hopefully, because Taiwan really needs to come together in the midst of so many dangers, right? But the second hope, Taiwan is an extraordinary place. I hope many, many Canadians will come and visit, and that will include many academic activities, many business activities, many diplomatic, everything. It's really an amazing place. That's why I keep coming back. And I feel always I miss it, right? Because the people are so warm, the place is so beautiful. At 20% of the butterfly biodiversity of the world, right? I mean, there's infinite number of extraordinary facts about Taiwan. And so, I hope we'll be able to more and more session engages and we'll get to a place where there's no more fear of war. And this, you know, Taiwan can have this beautiful society for a long time.
I know tariff and trade is important to every country, including Canada, and it needs to be taken into serious account by the Canadian government. But I want to say that it's also very important to look into the transnational repression and the foreign interference and economic coercion that both Taiwan and Canada has been faced with from the People's Republic of China, and that is in the long term that will have a huge impact on our countries. And about the security issue that you raised for the Taiwanese people, why are Taiwanese people are not afraid of it? We feel it, and it is just that it gets more and more serious concern from countries in the world, and there are a series of G7 statements, leader statements, saying that the peace and security in the Taiwan Strait is enormously important to every country in the region, because over 50% of the world trade passed through Taiwan Strait. It is critical to the world economy. So we have playing up and increase our self-defense capacity. And of course, we need like-minded country support. And I want to add that please stay strong as a Taiwanese. And then we want to continue to get support from like-minded countries such as Canada in terms of our meaningful participation in international arenas such as ICAO, WHO, and UNFCCC.
Those were the highlights of the discussion after the August 27th screening in Vancouver of filmmaker Vanessa Hope's documentary called Invisible Nation.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Taiwan news, Taiwan legislative speaker calls for expanded economic cooperation with the United Kingdom. Hong Kuo-yu meets with Trade Shadow Secretary Andrew Griffith. UK is Taiwan's third largest trading partner in Europe, with bilateral trade close to $8 billion. Han was confident that economic and trade ties between Taiwan and the UK would expand substantially. Griffith said the UK is committed to developing free trade, supporting a rules-based international order, and defending democratic values under threat. In Kyoto news, Japan PM Ishiba wins award for politician who looks best in glasses. The 68-year-old Japanese leader, who has decided to step down after about a year in office following setbacks in national elections, is the first sitting prime minister in 29 years to be chosen as the politician with the best-dressed eyes. The prime minister said he began wearing glasses after he was advised to do so to soften his image during a past leadership race for his Liberal Democratic Party. In ABC News Australia, VPNs, old man masks, and AI, the holes in the social media ban and their fixes. From December 10th, social media platforms will be forced to block under 16s in Australia from holding accounts, but experts warn age checks can be bypassed. Facial age estimation tools scan and analyze a person's face in order to guess their age, and is one of several technologies that the ban will depend on. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, emergency World Naked Bike Ride planned in Portland. Organizers of the World Naked Bike Ride say they're planning to protest President Donald Trump's decision to federalize 200 Oregon National Guard troops in Portland. The annual Portland event was created as a protest against big oil. So Trump is going after Antifa, and Antifa is going to take off their clothes and go for a bike ride. And by Antifa, I mean anti-fabric. In Cascade PBS, Olympia diaper guy named in $940,000 rent aid fraud investigation. Auditors flagged dozens of payments to Lance Benson's property management company as suspected fraud, but county leaders chose to go after the nonprofit aid distributor instead. Lance Benson is well known in Olympia for his nonprofit Dry Tykes and Wet Wipes. Local news profiles refer to the hometown businessman as the diaper guy. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Kushner buys stake in Burnaby video game studio. Same day father-in-law Trump threatens Hollywood North with tariffs. And exclusive, BC Lottery Corporation reports say problem gambling on the rise among sports fans. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to British Columbia's Jewish community in memory of the second anniversary of the October 7th massacre. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 5th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 5th of October in 1970, members of the Front de Libération du Québec kidnapped British Trade Commissioner James Cross to start the October Crisis? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.